Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Every day.
Here's John Williams.
It's exhausting. This is John. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio weekdays from 1 to 3. And well, Saturdays from 10 a.m. to noon. I won't be there this Saturday, but I'm sure the show will be in good hands. I think John Hansen's filling in for me on Saturday. He's pretty swell. I'm taking a little vacation here starting tomorrow, so you'll hear the likes of Pete McMurray and Justin Kaufman and others whose thoughts and voices you've come to know and love here at WGN Radio filling in for me tomorrow. That'll be Friday to Friday. We'll be with a bunch of listeners in London and Edinburgh, Scotland. When we talk about those trips, we really do go on those trips. And they really are fun, and we really do have breakfast and cocktails and sightseeing with y'all. And Brenda and I are really looking forward to it. Next trip I'm doing, and Steve Bertrand's organizing several with WGN listeners and personalities. Go to SteveBertrandTravel.com. The next one we'll be on after this trip to the UK will be in France. And I mentioned it briefly yesterday. I'll just remind you again if you were thinking about it but didn't do it. Brenda and I will be with a bunch of listeners in Paris at the end of this July and then through the first week of August, going up and down the Seine River, two nights in Paris and then a week on the Seine going from Paris to Normandy. We'll be there on the 75-year anniversary of D-Day. We'll spend 2 days in Normandy and then we'll cruise back sampling local wines and cheeses along the way in a virtually all-inclusive cruise. Oh, don't you want to do that? If you ever thought you'd want to do that, do that. Kelly Cruises is at 630-990-1111, 630-990-1111, kellycruises.com. And one last plug of stuff you can do with us while I'm standing here. Go to WGNradio.com/Jefferson. That's where you get tickets to see our show May 18th at the Classic Cinemas Tivoli Theater. That show's sponsored by the Joint Relief Institute. That should be a real thing. We were contemplating things we would ask Mr. Jefferson to comment on. There will be a slideshow portion of this year's program where images will be cast on the screen and he'll be asked to comment on slide of what? What would those things be that you'd like Jefferson to talk about? Issues or objects? We're going to show him a $2 bill and Mount Rushmore. Maybe an iPhone. I have a high-res picture of, that is a picture of a painting of Sally Hemings. I'm not sure if I'm going to throw that at him, but it is part of his history, so maybe he should comment on it. So I see that Ian Holzhauer was on Cochran's show the other day. Ian Holzhauer, the brother of James Holzhauer, was that today that he was on? James Holzhauer is the still-going, reigning Jeopardy champion, third place all time from, is it Naperville that he's from? And so the brother Ian came in and talked to Cochran this morning. He was on with us beforehand. And the brother, I think, is enjoying the celebrity limelight in some ways more than James is. James sent us a real nice note. And he said, since my focus is on sports and sports betting, I'm not comfortable talking on shows that are outside that. So, for instance, he was on Dan Patrick's show on ESPN. He was on TV in the studio with Dan Patrick, and they were kicking around stuff. Remember, the shows that you're watching on TV right now were done in February. So whatever the outcome is, it's already known. Point being that the pressure for Holzhauer to do well isn't really on. It's not like we're taking him out of his zone. Actually, unless he was correct for February, March, and April, maybe for two solid months he's been winning and he's a gazillionaire right now. But let's assume that's not the case. His run has somehow ended, although it's hard to imagine, right? But I don't think that we were distracting him from that. He just doesn't want to do regular old radio. So we told Ian, his brother, we said, well, listen, since sports is his bailiwick, maybe he'll come on our show and take calls about sports. We could talk to him about sports stuff. He could. I'd give him some time on the show to, you know, play radio. He doesn't seem to be too fazed by what's going on. He's an interesting fellow. Elif gave me some of the questions. Now, this is from a Vulture piece, and I think these were the ones that he got wrong. Is that what I'm looking at, Elif? I think these are questions that so far he got wrong. In 2018, this band didn't have a dime, but I always had a vision, always had high hopes. And then the answer would be, what is Panic at the Disco? A 1975 New York Daily News headline, after this man opposed a federal bailout, to city drop dead. Who would that be? American history was the category. I don't even see the answers here, Elif, so I don't think I know the answer to this one. A 1975 New York Daily News headline, after this man opposed a federal bailout, to city drop dead. Would that be Rudy Giuliani? What is the answer?
Gerald Ford.
New York City. Okay, so Gerald Ford's going to be the answer, right? So that's the problem with Jeopardy. You know, I sometimes with the reverse order and just the complicated Q&A they're trying to get from you anyway, sometimes I don't even know what they're talking about. A 1975 New York Daily News headline, after this man opposed a federal bailout to... Oh, so this is Gerald Ford saying to the city, drop dead, we're not going to bail you out. I got it. Okay, whew. Well, now I'll hit my buzzer, but I think it's a little late. 19th century exhibitions saw fire brigades competing either using water or in one of these, now a term for a practice effort. What did they put fires out? Not with a water brigade. Saw fire brigades competing either using water or in one of these, now a term for a practice effort. Well, a practice effort is a practice effort. I don't know. What's the answer to this?
Well, do you want a clue?
I don't think it'll help.
Rehearsal?
It's a synonym for rehearsal.
Okay, it's a synonym for rehearsal, Steve.
But all the components of the show won't be in that rehearsal.
I give up. What's the answer?
Dry run.
Oh, dry run. Yeah, sure. I know that.
Can I try? I'm going to go with dry run.
Dry run. American history. On June 1st, 1660, Mary Dyer, one of this religious sect's Boston martyrs, was hanged on Boston Common. What are they asking me there? One of this religious... Oh, so what religious sect was Mary Dyer hung for being a member of? Why don't they just do it that way? What was the religious sect that she belonged to?
She was a Shaker.
Shaker. Well, who are the Shakers?
Well, it rhymes with who are the Shakers.
I'll take that.
What's the answer?
The Quakers.
Oh, Quakers.
Oh, Quakers, Shakers. Recession, repression.
You gave me Shaker, and it rhymes with Shaker as a clue, a religious group that was persecuted, and I couldn't think of Quaker. That's just how bad I am at this. In 1903... Maurice Guerin was its first winner in 94 hours, 33 minutes, 14 seconds. That what is the cross country auto race? You know, New York to California.
Wrong.
Bertrand, go.
I don't know that one.
Lapkin, are you playing at all? Are you doing any of this?
It's making me feel stupid, but I would think some kind of like triathlon over 3 days.
Close.
A really long marathon thing.
It wouldn't be the marathon because it was 94 hours.
Right.
So
that's why I'm saying the ones that are days long. I can't remember.
Yeah. The real long triathlon thingy.
I have a clue for you.
Okay.
It's in the country where you're going in a few months.
It's in London.
In a few months.
And how many hours? I know what it is.
France.
It's the
Tour de France, yeah.
Five.
There you go.
The Tour de France.
Ding, ding,
the
ding,
Tour
Lauren.
De France.
Point goes to Lauren.
I know. I think
I'm a little
didn't...
less stupid.
Yeah, you're one for two. That's not bad.
If only we could get clues in Jeopardy.
I know. Alex, could you help me out there a little bit? Well, Constitution Day is September 17th. This related set is celebrated every December 15th. Now what are they asking us? Constitution Day is September 16th.
This related
set. So this it's another holiday related to that is celebrated every December 15th. I don't know, Declaration of Independence Day?
Close.
What is Declaration of Independence Day?
Incorrect. Close.
What is... I have
Articles of Confederation Day.
Incorrect.
What is the signing of the Constitution
No,
Day?
Come on. I know you know this.
It's not Emancipation Day, because that's already happened.
Is it a revolutionary thing? Something Jefferson and Washington, those guys did?
Okay. What's the thing that you pay for at the end of your meal?
Indigestion.
What is the thing you pay for? Yeah, the third cocktail. That's what I pay
That's
for.
Grim.
What is a Manhattan on the rocks?
Something about Bill
the
of Rights.
Bill of Rights.
Correct. Again, Lauren. Ding, ding, ding.
Boy, Lauren, you're really good at this if we give us a lot of clues and break it
right.
down for five
exactly,
minutes.
Yeah.
It's like if we lead
yeah.
the horse to water, you can drink.
You know, this is sort of like the Jeopardy on Saturday Night Live where they're all so stupid and Trebek loses his mind. You know, they get somebody playing Burt Reynolds and Tom Hanks and stuff like that. One of the best series of skits they've ever done.
Those are hilarious. My sister and her fiance went dressed as Burt Reynolds with a giant foam hat. And then another version of, like, Burt Reynolds. And it was probably the funniest costume I've ever seen.
Yeah, yeah. I love that hat. I was a Burt Reynolds fan when he was doing serious stuff, when he was doing silly stuff, when he'd make guest cameos on, you know, the old TV variety shows. Just anything Burt Reynolds did. When he was sitting there with Johnny Carson, and he just had that smirk on his face. Burt Reynolds didn't do anything wrong in my book. Probably didn't manage his money real well. But otherwise... You know, he was sort of like a more rascally George Clooney, right? And maybe not as bright, but, you know, what a fun guy. Do you have the audio? Okay, so just for the fun of it, since we've gone down this road, hit it, Elif.
Let's just go to animal sounds for 600. This is the sound a doggy makes. Mr. Connery.
Moo.
No.
Well, that's the sound your mother made last night.
See, it just it goes on like that. Sorry. Steve, I found the Marilyn Haggerty review of the Olive Garden from the Grand Forks newspaper.
Oh, nice.
What's the restaurant, your taco bar you're going to get?
Bar Taco.
Bar Taco. Kevin, have you been to Bar Taco? Kevin's in sports. I'm not sure he's dialed in right now. He's just working over there.
There's only one in Illinois, and it just opened. So.
And you guys, I just think it's kind of adorable. What town is this?
Deerfield.
Deerfield is really excited because they got a new franchise.
I can't speak
restaurant.
For everyone in the town. I'm just saying we're excited because, you know, you like new things and you want them to succeed.
I know that, but I think that when a franchise opens up another outlet in your town, it's not exactly like...
There's only like 10 of them in the country. It's not like... Olive
no,
Garden.
It's great. I'm happy for you. I'm
no, I don't think you are. I think you're looking
down.
You
have an Olive Garden? No, because they got this no. endless salad bowl, I'm telling you.
I'd love it. We'd have to drive 20 miles to get the Olive Garden.
So when Olive Garden came to the Grand
I
Forks
think.
Area, the review in the Grand Forks newspaper went like this. After a lengthy wait for Olive Garden to open in Grand Forks, the lines were long in February. The novelty is slowly wearing off, but the steady flow... the steady following attests the warm welcome. My first visit to Olive Garden was during mid-afternoon, so I could be sure to get in. After a late breakfast, I figured a late lunch would be fashionable. The place is impressive. It's fashioned in Tuscan farmhouse style with a welcoming entryway. There is seating for those who are waiting. My booth was near the kitchen, and I watched the waiters in white shirts and ties and black trousers and aprons adorned with gold-colored towels. They were busy at midday punching in orders and carrying out bread and pasta. It had been a few years since I ate at the older Olive Garden in Fargo, so I studied the two manageable menus offering appetizers, soups and salads, grilled sandwiches, pizzas, classic dishes, chicken and seafood, and filled pastas. At length, I asked my server what she would recommend. She suggested chicken Alfredo, and I went with that. Instead of the raspberry lemonade she suggested, I drank water. She first brought me the familiar Olive Garden salad bowl with crisp greens, peppers, onion rings, and yes, several black olives. Along with it came a plate with two long warm breadsticks. The chicken Alfredo, $10.95, was warm and comforting on a cold day. The portion was generous. My server was ready with Parmesan cheese. And it goes on like that. And people just ridiculed this. It's hard not to read it with almost a mocking voice, but I'm trying to resist that. Because when I read this the first time, and
you thought it was a satire, right?
No. I thought it was really sweet. I just thought it was, this lady's like 85 years old, and she's doing the Grand Forks restaurant reviews in South Dakota. And they got an Olive Garden, and they're really jazzed about it. And Olive Garden's a nice restaurant. And so what I loved about this was how self-conscious it wasn't. Right? She is treating this like a brand new big time restaurant in Chicago, and she's giving it the full on delivery. And she's not saying, I know it's a chain and they've got 200 of them in Chicago. All I'm saying is, here's my experience. And I just thought it was, you know, it was so unpretentious. It was perfect for me.
Well, I'm actually loving the way that she tells this story.
As I ate, I noticed the vases and planters with permanent flower displays on the ledges. There are several. There are several dining areas with arched doorways, and there is a fireplace that adds warmth to the decor. Olive Garden has an attractive bar area to the right of the entryway. The restaurant has a full liquor license and a wine list, offering a wide selection to complement Italian meals. Non-alcoholic beverages include coolers, specialty coffees, and hot teas. On a hot summer day, I will try that raspberry lemonade that was recommended. You know, I do think that was probably her drop in the ball. If you're doing a restaurant review, you can't have water. Unless you're going to review the water. Unless everybody's been wondering about the water.
Even more, if you're a waitress, you don't recommend the free water.
Well, I believe the waitress suggested the raspberry tea or lemonade.
I heard that wrong then.
Instead of the raspberry lemonade that she suggested, I drink water.
Oh, when you read that, I thought you said she suggested I drink water.
I'll read it one more time. She suggested the chicken Alfredo, and I went with that. Instead of the raspberry lemonade, she suggested I drink water. So she gets a glass of water. And then she just kind of wraps it up. There's a homemade soup, salad, and breadstick. The funny thing is she didn't really review it that much. She just told people about it. All in all, it is the largest, most beautiful restaurant now operating in Grand Forks. It attracts visitors from out of town as well as people who live here. Olive Garden is part of the Darden chain of restaurants that also operates Red Lobster. And finally, she writes, there are about 700 restaurants, including 4 Olive Gardens in North Dakota's major cities. Olive Garden's gained a following since 1982. It's known for classic lasagna, fettuccine, Alfredo, and chicken parmigiana.
By the way, Grand Forks is in North Dakota, according to our listeners.
See, Mr. Smarty Pants in Chicago. Well, again, I'm championing her cause here, but when I read this, I don't think I'm speaking out of school here. Newsman's Dave Stewart just kind of gave a long, slow roll. Like, really? And I say thank you, Marilyn Haggerty, for telling the people in both South and North Dakota about your Olive Garden experience. Ro Khan was on the air the other day. That's what he does. And he was talking about, and I just dialed this up, Al, if I didn't print it out. So forgive me that I don't know what the story is in Illinois. But if you're convicted of a crime, if you are in jail in Illinois, do you get to vote? 312-981-7200, if you've been in jail. Could you vote? You could text us, too. Maybe you're in jail right now. Give us a call. Maybe you should call your attorney first. But if you are in jail in Illinois, and say you're convicted of a felony, I mean, a terrible crime, or maybe you're just there because you didn't pay your parking tickets. Do you lose your right to vote when you're incarcerated? Now, the Democrats out there are talking about that. You have the answer to that, by the way?
Yes.
What is it?
In Illinois, individuals in prison for a felony conviction are ineligible to vote.
For a felony conviction, okay.
Yeah, so voting rights are restored upon release, and people on parole or probation can vote. And that's according to nonprofitvote.org.
But I think if you're in Cook County Jail, where you're awaiting a trial,
right?
I'm pretty sure that they bring people in there to register you, and you can vote.
Well, you should. I mean, said felony conviction.
Right. But back in the day, you would have to get to your polling place or get an absentee ballot.
Oh, that's interesting. But now they bring it to you.
I don't know.
312-981-7200 if you were in Cook County and they brought your ballot to you. I think they should. I think felons should get to vote. I'm really not sure why citizenship is, you know, we just did the Mincing Rascals podcast, and Patty Vasquez said, if you are in jail, aren't you still a citizen? And I said, yes. Well, then, you, because you do not lose your citizenship, you're still a citizen of the United States. And then she sort of inferred that part of citizenship is being able to vote.
Well, I think it's a deterrent. I'm not going to beat the out of that guy because I'd lose my right to vote.
Look, people who have nice houses, cars, and every opportunity to vote don't vote. I mean, we're just lazy to begin with. So and besides, think about all of the people that have maybe gone to jail for possession of marijuana, which we're about to decide shouldn't even be a crime. Maybe their voice should be heard. They should be voting for politicians who will legalize marijuana. I mean, I don't know why their voice doesn't matter. So Roe was not hearing it. Do I remember that correctly? Roe was just like apoplectic.
Yeah, he's not a fan of that.
Why is that part of the punishment? Why don't we whip them? We could get chains and we could hit them with whips. Well, we've decided that's not part of the punishment. Well, okay, how about voting? We could decide whatever we want. He made it sound like it's inherent in breaking the law that you therefore don't get to participate in voting, and nothing's inherent in it at all. We make decisions, and I think that's a silly decision.
Yeah, this is one of those issues I think that aren't so black and white, because how we got into the details is, you know, well, what kind of crime specifically did you commit? You know, a felony is a felony, but what type of felony? You know, you look at people like the Boston Marathon bomber, or you look at someone that, you know, committed armed robbery or something like that.
Yeah.
How about voter fraud?
Exactly. Who knows? Where do you draw the line? And I think his line was, they drew the line. They're behind the bars.
Yes. The line is the bars in front of you, Jack. And I think that's way too simple. One quick restaurant note. I was at the Cubs game last night with Lou Manfredini, our Mr. Fix-It.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you talk about me?
A little bit.
Okay, good.
It was a long game. So we had the Mickey Morandini. I did. Which is Doug's hot dog that they sell, at least in center field where we were. We were in the bleachers. Never sat in the bleachers before.
Really?
It was a nice view. My review of Wrigley and my whole experience was for $33. That was a good deal.
Yeah, that is. If you got in for $33, that's pretty good.
Well, I believe that was the face value of the bleacher seat.
Well, then did Lou buy the hot dog?
Lou is on that Seattle Sutton thing. He's no fun to eat with now.
How's he look?
Oh, he looks great. But you know, it's just, I was happy that he had a beer. It was probably a light beer, but you know, he's changing his lifestyle.
I like that. Good for him.
He looks great.
Was he scolding you for what you were eating?
And then I felt bad. So then I do the whole, I'm sorry. Is it okay? I felt like I'm having a beer in front of an alcoholic and you apologize, or a cigarette in front of an ex-smoker. I said, are you okay if I have a Mickey Morandini?
How does Mickey Morandini feel about that?
Well, it was pretty good.
What's on it? What is it?
Sharp mustard, hot peppers. It's a long hot dog with a kind of a roll of a bun, and then one other thing, some cheese, I think it was. And it was busier than I needed it to be, but it was delicious.
Nice.
Yeah, very good. It was a nice game yesterday, too.
That was a good game.
It's 1:38. The news click. Our daily web poll question asked you this: would you want to pay more in some state tax if the proceeds went to DCFS? This on the heels of the AJ Friend story yesterday, and 60% of you pledged, yeah, you'd pay more in taxes if we do more for child protective services for the likes of AJ. 60% said yes, 40% said no. We invited the governor to come on our show today and talk to you. As you were speaking to me about this yesterday, they said he does not have time to come on the radio today. I think that's a lost opportunity. He's talked about this issue before, and he may talk about it again, but he should be on the radio today. It's 1:38 on WGN. And an immigrant walk into a room. Hamilton, the exhibition world premiere in Chicago is April 26th, tomorrow, and Saturday, the 27th. This isn't the show, and they ain't singing and dancing at this exhibit, but there is a new, have you been reading about this? Exhibition coming to Chicago, and I think it's a permanent exhibit about Hamilton, the experience, and I think that's fascinating. And unique, and maybe a bit risky. the producer, Jeffrey Sellers, on a phone line. Jeffrey, it's John Williams. You're on WGN. How are you today?
Good afternoon, sir. I couldn't be better on this beautiful, sunny Chicago Thursday.
Now, that's selling. I already like your attitude, sir.
Well, when you're on Northerly Island, the sun means a lot.
I read the review or the description of it from Chris Jones in the Tribune, and one of my takeaways was, yeah, it's on Northerly Island, so it's not, say, in the theater district. But then again, it's not a theater production. And he described it as intriguing, but also maybe a little risky on your part. Jeffrey, tell us what you all have done over there.
We have created a museum exhibition that captures the founding of the United States of America, our American Revolution, how we took 13 disparate colonies and sewed them together into the country we live in today. And what we really do is take our visitors on a journey from the St. Croix Trading Post, where Alexander Hamilton worked as a 15-year-old, and bring you all the way through his life and then the early years of the United States of America, landing, of course, on the grassy knoll in Weehawken, New Jersey, where he met his tragic fate in a duel with Aaron Burr. What I wanted to do is find a way to entertain, educate, and illuminate folks about why our democracy is so important. And though we have amazing musical numbers like the Battle of Yorktown in our show, I still had questions like, but how do you actually win a battle? And in this museum exhibit, we're going to actually bring the visitors into George Washington's war tent, bring them right over the table where they plan it out, and we're going to actually show you on what I call our giant illuminated risk board, like that board game we played as kids.
Right, I remember.
And we're going to show you how we beat General Cornwallis in Yorktown.
Is this a permanent exhibit, or how long is it going to be at Northerly Island?
I think we've announced that it's going to be here for about 4 months. It is meant to tour, and we have not yet set a date to close the exhibit yet.
Do you worry that people will expect more entertainment than education? They love the show, but there ain't going to be no singing and dancing here?
Yeah, but you know what? This is, you know, I feel like this is part museum, but it's also part funhouse. And I think that we have found a lot of really great ways to explain how we created this country. For example, we're going to show you how Alexander Hamilton created the assumption of state debt, which sounds really boring,
right,
with a Plinko game machine.
Where you drop
the
thing down
and visitor are going to turn that crank and see that coin land and find out if you won money or you lost money through the assumption of state debt.
Yeah. Well, you don't know this about me, but 2 times a year I do a 2-person stage show with a guy who's either Teddy Roosevelt or Thomas Jefferson.
Oh, that's great.
And so in May 18th at the Tivoli Theater in the suburbs here, I'm going to be on stage with Thomas Jefferson, who, by the way, does not like your play one bit.
Yeah, but hey, come on, he has a really good part, and it's arguable he might even have one of the best numbers in the show.
I would put the King George number up there with it, but yeah, listen, he's a central figure, but I also think he might not like the way he's portrayed. I mean, against the backdrop of Alexander Hamilton, Jefferson doesn't fare well. They were not friends, those two.
They were not friends, but as we did learn, when push came to shove, Hamilton thought that Jefferson would be a more appropriate, effective, inspiring president than, of course, Aaron Burr.
Well, he's got that going for him. But, you know, here's, if I may, just to go down history road for a second, and that's kind of what your exhibit is about. You're right. Listen, I am proof. We've been doing a show like this for about 20 years, and we sell it out, and there's laughs, but there's also a real dialogue about what it means to be an American. And Jefferson tells us this whenever Hamilton comes up. He said he didn't trust you. He felt that you shouldn't have a direct vote, that we could usurp your vote. He didn't believe in the rabble. It was more up to these egalitarian types to make the decisions for us low-class folks. That's not America, says Jefferson.
Yeah, but there are always two sides to every story. And when you dip into your wallet and take out that credit card and make the kind of purchase that might buy dinner or might buy accessories for your new house, that is a financial system that was designed by Alexander Hamilton that we are still benefiting from today.
Hold on, I'm writing this down.
But beyond even me, you know, defending Hamilton or not, I think what you're bringing up is the great American experiment in which we need politicians who vociferously disagree with each other and fight for their ideas so that hopefully the best idea wins and then we all benefit.
That's just so eloquently put, and I couldn't agree with you more. And by the way, I'm going to mention that to him. I'm going to say, hey, most of the people that are going to be at our show pay with their credit cards. So I'm going to tell Jefferson, if it wasn't for Hamilton, we wouldn't even be here right now.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. I don't think people realize, but when we were on the precipice of a complete financial meltdown in 2008, what would have melted the economy is the notion that there would have been no overnight credit, which means banks won't lend to each other overnight, which means the entire credit card industry would have shut down.
So you and I are having this conversation. So you are the producer of Hamilton.
Yes,
and
sir.
That's such a just a, you know, game changing, entertaining thing. And it's been fantastically profitable. Did you all, when you started down that path, ever think that you would then be doing this sort of historical museum piece?
Not on your life. I did it. I thought we were just making a good show. And what Hamilton revealed was that more than just making a good show, we were illuminating history in a way that was teaching people in a fun and dynamic way about history and that they had never been taught before. So it became an educational vehicle that I never really anticipated would be so powerful. And it also became an inspirational vehicle that really shows us how what we share as Americans in our values is so much deeper than our differences politically.
Well, let's hope so. And so did you have an epiphany, or was it Lin-Manuel was there a point where somebody said, wow, this is a great show, we need to do more, we almost have an obligation to turn this fun into something even more meaningful, more thoughtful?
Well, it was some of my theater colleagues who had already ventured into this burgeoning museum business, and they brought me the idea saying you could do an amazing exhibit that would be both history and entertainment. And then what I thought was, A, this will be a great adjunct to our very powerful education program in which we're bringing 250,000 kids to see Hamilton all over America over the next 3 years.
Yeah.
And it would really give our visitors this fun experience of not just sitting in a seat, but literally walking through the American Revolution, walking through the creation of the 13 United States of America that launch our country. And then, of course, being able to stand on that grassy perch where that sad, tragic duel took place.
Okay,
this is your chance to be in it.
Here's a bad idea. No, well played. But here's a bad idea.
Yeah.
Somewhere in the exhibit, maybe on the lawn over there, because I got some green space over there at Northerly Island, you have a long lawn and people get to duel. You know, you get to...
That's the bad idea, no question. But I will sell you a panini after you finish the museum, and you can have a very nice panini with your wife or your husband or your children and look at the incredible skyline of Chicago just over the way.
One last question. Bravo to you. Good luck to you. Are you worried at all that this won't take, though, that it's inspired, but people don't do that? What do you think about that?
Sure. Anytime we set out to make something new, I'm always worried, but I always follow my heart, which is that, can I make something that gives me a good time, that I find to be entertaining and fun and inspiring? And if I please myself, then I've done my job, and I hope that others follow.
Somebody texted in at the beginning of the Broadway show, two ropes are draped across the stage. I didn't get it. What's that all about?
Two ropes are draped across the stage. They're not draped across, but what we do is we have what is called a portal, which is around the proscenium, and we have these very old wooden beams, and some of those ropes are bound together with rope, which shows a country under construction, which is what we still are.
And my last question is, were you involved at all in the casting and the kinds of people that played the roles?
Of course. And I want to say that when author Lin-Manuel Miranda and director Thomas Kail first started sharing with me all of the songs, and we did our first teeny little read-through in a very small room up in Manhattan, they immediately started using their friends to play those roles, and they were all the folks who could do this kind of hip-hop, and it just made perfect sense that they were women and men of color. And we followed the text, and the text required that, and then it just made perfect sense that here we were doing America yesterday as told by America today.
So there was a little duality, right? There was a message in the casting itself, though.
There winds up being a message without even having to state it, but what makes perfect sense is that the principal communication tool in this, which is rap, is an African-American art form formed in the late 70s and the early 80s. So it made perfect sense that we used African-Americans and other folks of color to play these roles.
Right. If there's any incongruity in that in people's mind, how incongruous would it be to see white people maybe singing and dancing that way, too? That's not a perfect fit either, is it?
Well, you know what? What we're finding out is that the best way to tell these stories is through the natural melting pot that is our country.
You are out of time. I am out of time. Well, I'm just really anxious to see it. So the ribbon cutting is, I think, going to be, is it tomorrow or Saturday?
Yeah, we're going to, Lin-Manuel will be here to cut the ribbon tomorrow night at 5, and we open the doors to the Chicago citizens and visitors tomorrow, at Saturday morning at 10 a.m.
The website is HamiltonExhibition.com. It's at Northerly Island, right on the lake, HamiltonExhibition.com. What a pleasure to visit with you, Jeffrey. Congratulations, and what I think is going to be a real successful run here in Chicago and on the road, too. Thanks for joining us.
What a pleasure. Have a great afternoon.
Jeffrey Seller is the producer of Hamilton and obviously one of the key players in this exhibit at Northerly Island.
Thinking big thoughts. So you don't have to.
These are hard.
Here's John Williams.
Still looking at some of the questions from Jeopardy that James Holzhauer was asked. We have the list of the ones he got wrong with the answers. Let's play Are You Smarter Than the Jeopardy Champ from Chicago, whose brother was on with Steve Cochran today and was on the phone with us a day or two before that. Holzhauer's are rocking it. The category is Route 66. Modern auto safety took a big step in 1966 as LBJ signed bills mandating seatbelts and rupture-resistant these.
Rupture-resistant windshields.
These. I want to say.
What are rupture-resistant windshields?
Right, I think it would be tires, right? Oh. Like the tire blows out and the car crashes.
That's what I thought.
That's a better rupture. Oh, don't jump on board there, Lauren.
I was seriously thinking it. I wouldn't lie.
Yeah, but you didn't go, ah. Or,
yeah, a windshield wouldn't rupture.
Elif, what was the answer to the one modern auto safety took a big step in 1966 as LBJ signed bills mandating seatbelts.
LBGTQ.
Would you let me finish the question? LBGTQ, the president in 1966, had rupture-resistant these.
Fuel tanks.
Ah!
Fuel tanks.
Hey, Laura. Hey, Lauren, you were wrong.
So were you, John.
Well, there's them.
I was also thinking maybe airbags.
Yeah, but it was way before airbags. That's what...
I thought you said a good one.
Yeah,
66, right? Well, yeah. When did those come out? So many things I don't know.
So more Jeopardy questions that he got wrong, and I guess we did too. By the way, one last thing before we go to Phil Vitale, the restaurant critic at the Chicago Tribune. I'm confused now. We were walking through the generations, like the Greatest Generation, and then...
No, that's not one.
Yeah, I know. That's what I told Elif. I said the generation that preceded ours was the Greatest Generation. You know, our parents, the World War II parents.
Yeah, but that's not... I mean, that was almost created by Tom Brokaw, wasn't it?
I
mean,
right.
I don't know.
I thought he coined the phrase.
Right.
I don't know. Back up. Oh, so preceding the Greatest Generation. No. the
baby boomers.
Right. So start there, Elif, and walk us through what the generations are, please.
The order of common generational names go baby boomers, Gen X, millennials, also known as Gen Y, and Gen Z, or iGen, John.
So the young people now are Gen Z, but the one that's before, baby boomers. What do they call that? I said the Greatest Generation. What's the one that precedes my generation, right? Because I'm a baby boomer.
Silent Generation.
The Silent Generation. That doesn't have a... ring of familiarity.
I feel like they just came up with that one too recently. But
I think Elif just made that one up.
No, but I've heard that.
Yeah.
Don't insult me, John.
What's the one before that then? Before Silent Generation? If you go back to the turn of the century, what would they call those folks then?
G.I. Generation, John.
G.I. Generation. That'd be maybe World War I, then the Silent Generation, then the Baby Boomers, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. Phil Vitale's the restaurant critic at the Chicago Tribune. He normally joins us Wednesdays. We asked him to come on Thursday of this week. He's on the phone right now. Hi, Phil.
Hi, John.
Would you have gotten that right, the order of generations?
No, I would have missed Silent Generation, but, you know, that's the 20s, so I'm okay. I'm okay with that.
Are you a baby boomer,
yeah,
sir?
You know, because I'm a baby boomer, by definition, I'm only concerned with my generation.
Well, I think that's the slam on millennials, and I think that ship has sailed or is sailing too. You know,
yeah.
We say it's all about them, and they want everything handed to them. They want ping pong tables and sous chefs at work, which they do, and it makes me crazy that they get it. But I think that there's a lot of great traits about millennials that we don't appreciate.
Give them what they want because they're funding us baby boomers in retirement.
I know. Just make them happy. Let's get them big incomes so they can pay taxes and contribute to Social Security. And I think that they are more socially responsible. I think they're more socially conscious. I think they are probably better savers, some of them. I mean, those that are lucky enough to have good jobs. They don't drink and drive the way we used to. I mean, there's a lot of attributes that I think you could hand to millennials that are better than their fathers and mothers.
Thank you.
Yeah, I would include my kids among that.
Hey, Phil, so for Easter, we had... ham and egg bake and all the traditional stuff in the morning. But then with another bunch of people in our family, we did an evening version of Easter. And we were pretty tired and we didn't want to cook twice. So we went to Duck Duck Goat and ordered out that Chinese food. Phil, that is a game changer. Do you agree?
I agree. It's a very good restaurant.
It was... And they said, well, it's kind of this new Chinese thing. And I thought, I don't want new Chinese thing. I want food in a little bucket with some rice and some egg in there. And that's what it is. At least the takeout was. Like if you get the pork fried rice, it looks like pork fried rice. If you get the beef and broccoli, it looks like beef and broccoli. If you get
the
short ribs, it looks like it's that stuff. But it's so much more flavorful. It's everything about it is better.
It's Chinese food, including some very traditional recipes, done by an extremely good and award-winning chef. She would probably not call her cuisine Chinese so much as she'd call it Chinese inspired. And I think the very name Duck Goat is meant to give a little wink to the. You know, we're not telling everybody we're authentic here.
Girl and the Goat, and then what's her third restaurant?
She's got... Little Goat Diner, and she just opened Cabra, which is a Peruvian-inspired restaurant.
Stephanie Izzard, we're talking
name
about.
For, yeah. takes the Spanish name for goat and make that the title.
Ah, Stephanie Izzard. So she is still staying with the goat theme, but now she's gone multilingual there, huh?
Well, Izzard is actually the name of a species of goat that is found in the Basque region. So it's kind of self-referential anyway.
Ah, and this new place, you said, is that up and running? How's that doing?
It's up and running. I went online to make a reservation, and they're booked till Judgment Day. So it's going to take me a while to get in. 5 o'clock, 5 Tuesdays from now is looking kind of okay. Yeah, it's very popular. It's the new Hoxton Hotel that opened up at the corner of Green and Lake Streets, and Cabra is the rooftop restaurant. Now, it's not a very tall building, but they're still the rooftop, and so it's mostly covered, some outdoors, and it's right next to the hotel pool, so you can sort of have your Peruvian ceviche and a cocktail and watch people splash in the pool. At the same time.
Stephanie Izzard place, and that's called Cabra at Green and Lake Street, huh?
Yeah, in the Hoxton Hotel, which is a small boutique chain of hotels.
The pot stickers, oh, I didn't even have them. Brenda had them on a previous visit, and my kids had them previously as well. And I guess they don't make those, at least for takeout, on weekends. That's a funny rule. But there I was on a weekend trying to get the pot stickers. And so I looked at the guy and I did that thing that you do with your eyes, where I just go, really? Because I'm thinking they probably got a bucket of pot stickers in there.
Right.
You know, don't tell me you don't have pot stickers. You're not going to sell it to me, but if I do this with my eyes, you're going to go, oh, look at that poor man. He's standing there on the take-up window. His car's double parked. Let's give him some pot stickers. He said, we don't have pot stickers on weekends. I don't know if she's listening, but you don't have pot stickers on weekends? What is that? And the chicken wings were just delicious. There's a piece in the Chicago Tribune, Phil. You know this well, although you didn't write it. It was rooftop restaurants. Now that the weather's getting warmer, that people should know. Give me two or three highlights for rooftop dining in Chicago.
Well, let's see. Roof being a relative term, Etta, a restaurant I believe you enjoy on North Avenue at 1840 West North Avenue. Their second floor is open to the elements, and it sort of looks out over the neighborhood. It's a rooftop. I mean, it's only two stories up, but it's still a rooftop, and that's a good one. ABBA, which is in the always hot Fulton Market District at the corner of Green and Fulton Market, their rooftop, I think they're about three or four stories up in the air.
Yeah.
That one was so popular that they spent the sort of off-season this winter putting coverings over a lot of it because they were losing potential income when the weather wasn't very nice.
Oh,
they said,
I see.
We got to fix that. So they did. And that's Mediterranean food, and that's another one where you need a crowbar to get into. Something new that I haven't been into, the Hotel Essex on Michigan Avenue, 800 South. That's been redone, the whole hotel. And up top they have something called Essex Sky Bar, where you can look out over Grant Park, and it's the pictures look really sleek and just the sort of place doesn't want me in there, you know. And but it's going to be popular, very popular.
Yeah.
And further north on Michigan Avenue, in the Peninsula Hotel, one of my favorites all time, and this is not new now, is the outdoor space adjacent to Shanghai Terrace, which is a beautiful outdoor terrace. You still have a lot of the Michigan Avenue buildings much taller than it kind of surrounding you, so you sort of have a concrete canyon effect, but you have this beautiful pastoral sort of light wood and full of greenery kind of environment. I like that a lot.
And give us that location again, Phil.
That's in the Peninsula Hotel, 108. Well, it's on Michigan Avenue. The address is really 108 East Superior, but it's on Michigan Avenue, and adjacent to the Shanghai Terrace restaurant. Out in Naperville, back again for its second summer, is Santo Cielo, which is a upscale Mexican restaurant by the Ator Madre people. they were kind of taking over the western suburbs in terms of all things Mexican. And that's a very nice place in downtown Naperville.
All right. A few suggestions. By the way, when you hear us talk about these places and you're not writing them down because you say, oh, gee, what was the one with the thing? We always podcast these segments. So just go to WGNradio.com, click on the John Williams Show page. You'll find it. And then there'll be a picture of Phil Vitale and me, and you can hear this and take notes dutifully afterwards. I appreciate you being flexible enough to come on with us today, Phil. Let's get you back in the studio, and we'll do the always popular Phil's Flash Fry next time we're both in the studio together, okay?
Excellent. Looking forward to it.
Nice to talk to you, sir. Thanks for your time.
You too.
I mentioned that I went to the Cubs game last night with Lou Manfredini. We had a swell time. As we were walking from my place, I don't live too far from the park, from my place to Wrigley, we were going by some condos, and we were just talking about the neighborhood. And I said, well, watch this, because I think Lou may have asked, oh, how much do one of those go for? Who lives in these buildings? And I pulled out this app called HomeSnap, and it has a camera function. And when you see in your viewfinder on your phone, it actually has a little frame of a house. So you look through that sort of outline of a house at the building you want to take a picture of. In my case, it was a condo building, but it could be a home, whatever. And then you take the picture. Ch-kunk. And then it instantly calls up the listing of that house. You see what it's worth, how many bedrooms, what the taxes are, does it have air conditioning, etc. If it's not on the market, you get its price history and stuff that's generally out there. But all you got to do is just walk up and take a picture of it. I was showing this to my folks the other day at their place in Joliet, and they go, really? How's that work? And I just took a picture of the house that we were in. I said, here, watch this. Click. And then brum, there came up their history. How much they paid for it. How much the previous people paid for it. Everything about a house that you would maybe find with some clicks on your phone or a laptop is on this phone. And you can either search by taking the picture of it out the window of your car, for crying out loud, as you're driving by it, or you can type in an address if you like. When a map comes up, say you've taken a picture and it shows you where it is on a map, it'll show you the other homes there, and you can just touch those with your finger, and then boom, you get the national multiple listing on that as well. It's just really convenient, and it's amazing how much information can just fall into one space instantly. Now, this is not a commercial for that app. We will be doing commercials for them down the road, and you'll probably hear them. But this is the tail wagging the dog. I fell in love with this and started telling people about it. Paul Wells is the treasurer of this thing, if I'm not mistaken, of the company that does this. Hey, Paul, it's John. You're on the air. How are you?
Good afternoon, John. How are you today?
Pretty good. It says treasurer of BPP. What's BPP?
The Broker Public Portal, that's the connection that HomeSnap has to the MLSs across the United States.
I see. You're also on the board for HomeSnap. How long has this app been out there?
Oddly enough, it's actually been around since about 2008.
Wow.
But the BP, and again, they had some legs, but not enough. They really needed a connection to the real estate community. And we formed that in 2015, and that was the tipping point.
So how many people use it now?
Well, there's over 3 million people that are using it around the country now. In fact, that was just last month alone, 3 million consumers, and 1 million realtors have access to it now.
It's a free app. You said consumers, but I don't pay to use this, right?
No, it's absolutely a free app, and it's funny because we're finding many people are doing what you are doing, and that is playing with it, and it's the most addictive toy out there.
I know, because you might as well just walk right in their house. Because there's pictures, too. So you can just go up and down your block and go, here's the Johnsons, here's the Smiths, click, click, click.
One of the things that I like about it, too, is you can also do that from a survey standpoint, meaning if you click on the map function, you can walk around the property, and it geo-tracks where you are exactly on the property, so you can see exact property lines of any property around.
Hmm. Well, they also have the issue, if you're traditionally looking on a computer, you'll see something on Zillow or some real estate website, and they'll show you the street view. They'll show you the map view. Some of them show you an overhead view. You guys have all three of those lined up, which is, again, just super convenient.
Well, the goal was exactly what you're saying. We needed to give the consumers what they were asking for that other portals weren't. And the biggest thing that consumers have been complaining about is not having accurate data, meaning if they pulled up a house that said it was for sale, that it actually sold 2 months ago, but they weren't reporting that it sold 2 months ago. HomeSnap's data is live and accurate.
Yeah. I'm surprised that, I mean, I guess there's other apps like this out there, and all the real estate companies have their ways to connect with people, but this is like so obvious. I guess, to me, the genius of this is this information's available, but nobody has, in my experience, so succinctly put it into one space. You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you're saying, and it kind of almost feels like an overnight success that only took 13 years.
Yeah, right. But now people are really finding out about it. And I guess why I'm so enthusiastic about it right now is just because I think our listeners will benefit as there's a lot of this. It's spring. People are out shopping for homes now. The season's, the market's hot. And this is just a really good tool. It's called HomeSnap. Do you type in one word or two when you're searching HomeSnap?
One word, HomeSnap. That's it.
And then, and the snap is the taking of the picture. Is that how people do it? Do they mostly take a picture of the property and get the listing, or do they dial in an address?
Most people are using it as an address function because they may drive by something or hear about or read about a specific property. But you're playing and enjoying the product as the picture is even more of a depth perception of what's going on with that property, especially because it's pulling up anything. Any home, anywhere, even if it's never been on the market.
Right.
It's giving you all the information about that property.
Yeah, that's true.
It's amazing.
Well, and so, but that's a good point because I thought, well, why wouldn't people take a picture? But maybe I'm in Chicago and the house is for sale in Joliet. Rather than driving out there and taking its picture, I can just type in the address and it pops into my phone.
Well, that's a point well taken. Right now we're in 48 of 50 states. So if you're moving to California and you find a house on 127 Juniper and you're sitting in Chicago, you can pull up everything in that house in a millisecond without having a photo.
On the houses that aren't on the market, you those are listed as well, essentially. You have information on those as well, right?
Exactly. And it has not only the current information, so they might have sold 3 years ago. It's going to have an entire history of what's happened in that property.
But I noticed
everything from sale prices to taxes.
Yeah, but I noticed, say, on houses that aren't on the market right now with the HomeSnap app, that, and you're on the board, you're involved in this, they will show you what the market for that is, right? Like, it'll give you a range. So if it's a $200,000 house, it might say 165 to 215 or something like that, correct?
Right, and we felt that's important. That's very, very important because a lot of the other portals are giving the exact prices. They've never seen the property. And you can have two houses exactly the same next door to each other. One was updated in 1972, and one was updated yesterday afternoon. Those have two different values.
Well,
so that's why we thought the range was important.
Yeah. I wonder, too, if you were factoring in the market. In some cities, it's a buyer's market. In some, it's a seller's. The general economy affects home prices, too, interest rates. So I wonder if that thing sort of slides depending on where the market is at any time.
Literally slides in real time. So every minute something changes, that number is changing.
Yeah. Okay, so this is called HomeSnap. I don't know what else to ask you. I think people need to get it and play with it, but or use it if they're so inclined. But it's fun if you're not in the market, but if you are in the market, certainly as a buyer, this is it just could not be more easy to have this thing in your hand.
Well, remember, too, that it's available online as well, so you can just type homesnap.com, and there's 150 people, million people that used it last year alone. So it's going to keep on taking on strength, but the more people use it, the deeper the knowledge and database gets, and the more they'll enjoy it.
And so if I was using it, though, on my laptop, I wouldn't be using the camera function, obviously. I would be using it as more just a traditional search site then, right?
Correct. And some people, although I will say that most searches today for homes are done on a mobile device, but some people are sitting in their office or sitting at home and want to mess around. It's the same kind of data that's out there. It's just accessed in a different way.
And a lot of times
when you look at a house, you want a bigger picture of that living room anyway.
Don't get in car crashes now. I was literally pointing my camera out the window or my phone out the window. And be careful. That's all I'm going to say. Be careful if you're using HomeSnap. It's too easy to use. Paul Wells is with that app called HomeSnap. All right, Paul. Nice to meet you. Congratulations. You guys got a going concern there, my friend.
John, thanks for having fun with it, and keep on enjoying and playing with it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. If you know someone that's looking for a house, I'd look for that. You want me to give you more of the trivia of the Jeopardy questions James Holzhauer got wrong?
I'd rather you gave us easier ones, but...
Well, these are the ones he got wrong, and he's the smartest person alive.
Right, that's my point.
The category is Don't Tread on Me. A 2016 interview with this Batman actor found him looking sad. The internet then made him the meme we deserve.
Well, 2016, wouldn't that have been the Ben Affleck era?
Okay. We'll go Ben Affleck. The producer Elif is monitoring our answers here. Is it Ben Affleck, producer Elif? Do you know? It is?
Yes.
Oh, my God, yay! Cow.
She is a force to be reckoned with.
My God.
I'm just a nerd. That's all I got. I'm not smart.
Well, again, if they slow the show down, if they really slow the show down and give hints, I think we could all do fine on Jeopardy.
She did that one hintless.
Yeah. I'll bet somebody else. Why am I taking anything away from her? I didn't have the answer. Congratulations, Lauren Lapka.
Thank you. I had to get at least one.
No, you've done all right on that today. Walter Jacobson is in our studio, the legendary newsman whose commentaries are frequently heard on WGN Radio's Steve Cochran show in the morning. Hi, Walter. How are you?
I'm okay.
Walter had something. Walter had an interesting observation coming in. He said, may I share what you said?
Sure.
It's clean. It said, boy, wouldn't it be nice if the Bears got Robbie Gould back?
Wouldn't it be?
No. So
but
you're
it doesn't, doesn't look very likely.
No.
He has missed 3 field goals total since he left the Bears. how wonderful that would be. But they'll never get that game back, so.
Well, isn't that funny? You know, I mean, and I think Bears, we did a news click on this, our web poll question. We said, do you want Bobby Gould back? Robbie Gould back? And I'm trying to remember what we got on that. Do you remember what the numbers were on that, Elif? Maybe you can look it up.
I believe yes won.
Yeah, I'll bet it did.
Sure. Yeah.
I'll bet it was 80-20. You know, until he misses one, and then everybody wants him out of town, and we want somebody else.
I say 85.
85? All right, we'll look it up. See if you can find that, Elif. Walter's commentary today wasn't about football. It was about CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News. What did you say?
And that's football, too.
That's a tackle sport.
I say I feel really bad about this. You know, if you're a news junkie, you have to, as I am, and I do, love cable television. I mean, when Ted Turner started that, 40 years ago, the first 24-hour news, I'm a news junkie. You're pretty much a news junkie, too. I think that I watch cable news maybe literally 2 hours a night when I get home. And I work out a little bit, and then I start to cook dinner. And while I'm cooking dinner, or Susie was cooking dinner, I'd watch. I'd tune in CNN, then I'd go to MSNBC, and then I'd go to Fox. I could stay there a minute or two, and then go back. And I just can't stop. You know, it is so interesting right now. And the disappointing thing to me is that I think Donald Trump is making a fool of cable news. I think cable news has turned into an opinionated, unfair, far-reaching, extreme example of what ought not be done on television news or any news. We're supposed to be, at least try to be, objective. I know there's no such thing as total objectivity, but they don't even try. And the worst of it is, I don't want to get on a preacher stand here, but the worst of it is that especially CNN presents itself as a purveyor of news, and it's no less a purveyor of opinion than Fox is on the other end of the spectrum.
Do you think that's new in CNN's case?
I think it's growing. It certainly wasn't new at the beginning, not with people like Evans and Novak, and they were that at that point being as well. That was the key purpose of television news back then, to be objective, get both sides of the argument. We need both sides of the argument. And more importantly, it seems to me, we need to know when the cable television stations are slipping into opinion.
Well, that's what's hard to tell, don't you think? I mean, because all three of those networks, and CNN, you're right, purports to be in the middle, but it's, I think, easily lost on people, is the person telling me about the president or Rahm Emanuel or whatever the story is the person that's telling me this delivering news, or are they doing what John Williams does, delivering opinion, right?
And you see what you just said, what John Williams does. They would never say that. And they are doing it. In fact, I would say that what's going on right now, provoked by Donald Trump, no doubt, is worse than it's been in the past, and it's so extreme that you announce that you're giving your opinion. You're happy to say that. Why don't they do that? Why don't they do that? Let us feel better about it.
Do you think that CNN and being blurring the line between news and opinion is also blurring it to the left? Is it too much of a liberal news network?
Oh, well, yes, honestly. I mean, I lean toward the liberal side in my politics, although I don't vote very often because I don't want to be tagged as a liberal or a conservative or a Republican or a Democrat. I have trouble with that when I'm on the air trying to talk about something that's happened in politics. But certainly the slant of most of the media is more liberal than it is conservative. The people who are in it are college graduates, reporters, thinkers. It's a job, and that tends to lead toward a more liberal point of view of things.
Yeah, when they say, well, the media is filled with liberals, I'll own that.
Yeah.
I mean, whatever the definition of liberal is, if it means people who have a little bit of higher education, the job requires it. If it means people who vote Democrat, I don't know, for some reason those things go together. I guess that's the way it is. I don't think there's a sin in that, Walter, as long as those people still do their job credibly. If a quote-unquote Democrat says Donald Trump's economy is good, then I think that's, if the economy is good, I think they need to say that, even though they don't like the man.
And I think they do that. It's the issues that are very debatable where they slip off the edge of objectivity into straight opinion that I don't like. And Trump is using them for it. Trump wants to be impeached, or he wants the process to begin, because he knows he can victimize himself, especially in the eyes of the right wing. And the anchors...
they fall right
into
that.
Anderson Cooper and now Wolf Blitzer, all of them, Lawrence McDonald, and especially Rachel Maddow, they fall into that trap. Why don't they know better?
Okay, would you be happy, because Rachel Maddow doesn't want to. She's a liberal who doesn't like the president, and she wants to tell you that. So what's Rachel Maddow supposed to do?
Well, I guess you have answered the question yourself. She is supposed to do what is most successful. And it doesn't surprise me at all that the network or the cable news managers are telling Rachel Maddow and Lawrence O'Brien, and I'll bet Anderson Cooper too, or maybe they don't even have to be told, but they know that since the early days of Bill O'Reilly, controversial expressed opinion gets viewers. And they all know that to be successful, they've got to do things that will get viewers. They need the ratings. Ratings are higher. Fox News, starting with Bill O'Reilly, has doubled the combined audience of CNN and MSNBC. And it's not simply because he's conservative. It's simply because he takes a strong stand and says it. And announces, he's more, says things more as you just did. He said, it's my opinion. And so the other stations, MSNBC and CNN, have followed that lead. And those anchors are trying, they must save their positions as big anchors.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's the ratings game that will determine their fate. I wonder then if there'd be a way to do like a CNN 2, where it would be put all the opinion shows there. And maybe it would make you happy if they did more traditional neutral news, whatever that means, 24 hours a day on CNN. And then on this other CNN channel I'm inventing, Rachel Maddow goes there and Wolf Blitzer goes there and Anderson Cooper goes there. Maybe that would satisfy you. I mean, you're not against Rachel Maddow having an opinion and putting it on TV, are you?
No.
But it bothers you. I like watching
it.
Yeah. And it's funny because you probably agree with her more than the stuff you're seeing on Fox News.
Oh, more than what I see on Fox News. But I catch Rachel Maddow, you know, being a kind of a student of television journalism. I watch more than just what's being said about the government today. I watch how the anchors are performing. That's just part of my habit because I was one. Still am doing it. And so it's my thing that I like to see and analyze and think about and then analyze. And Rachel Maddow, I catch her at least twice a night saying things that are absolutely wrong. Or And I know they're wrong because all the news comes out before and after that shows they're wrong. And she's also bothersome, and most of the cable news people are right now, is quoting the New York Times. They get into something very controversial. Rachel will say, such and such has done such and such a bad thing, according to the New York Times. And I scream at my TV. And I say, well, damn it, is that fair, what the Times is saying? Don't just say it's according to the New York Times. You got to say whether the New York Times got it right or wrong. And 93% of the news in the New York Times on Trump has been negative, as it is on CNN. That was a Harvard study done not too long ago.
Is it possible that 93% of the time Donald Trump is bad?
Oh, it's possible.
I'm trying to think. I'm glad you're saying this. I'm especially glad you're saying this on this show, Walter. I'm not criticizing you.
No, please do.
But I wonder if, here's what the president does. He hears negative things about him, maybe because he's an ill-equipped, incurious, lying, bad man, and and the country suffers for it. And if CNN tells you the truth about that, of course it's going to sound bad. These are accurate statements about bad traits. So are they supposed to sugarcoat it? Now, if it's 93%, then I'd say they need to broaden their news wheel. I've wondered at times. People ask me, why don't you say more good things about the president? And honestly, sometimes I can't think of any. And I watch Fox News too. I read Drudge. And sometimes I can't think of good things to say. And I wonder, his last thought is, I just think out loud, Walter. I wonder sometimes if I have an obligation to sort of balance it. Okay, we said that Trump lied and the Mueller report was negative, although, you know, it didn't convict him of anything. But maybe to sort of satisfy the people that are unhappy with what I believe is the truth I'm telling them, maybe I should come up with something good about the president. I don't know the answer to that.
I don't mean saying nice things about Donald Trump just to be nice, or even if you want to put it in the context of fairness, just to balance. I don't think we have to say that Donald Trump is, every time we say Donald Trump's done something bad, that we should then say something good. I'm focused more on the current controversy at each time. Now the current controversy is impeachment. Mm-hmm. And it's so clear. This, the guy who's really emerging at MSNBC, Ari Melber, He's now aiming to replace Rachel as the most provocative liberal person on television. And the guests he has on always are on that point of view. I don't like that. It bothers me so much. And I don't want to hear something good about Trump just because it needs to be balanced. I just want to get a focus on an issue and make sure that that issue is being explored fully. And that's what I don't think is happening. And that, well,
one thing that I notice that CNN does, and I've been critical of them once they started it, the president will give a speech. He'll talk for, he's in Green Bay, I think, this weekend. You watch, they're going to do this. They'll put on the front page, above the fold, if you will, on their website, they'll do the 25 craziest things Donald Trump said. And then you click through, and it's something he said, and then something he said that's incendiary or controversial or whatever. But it's just clickbait. It's just enticing you to get agitated at the president by putting the craziest things he says in front of his fans. We know how he talks. They don't need to write that article at all. In my estimation.
Oh, and they do that over and over and over again. A story that's not a hugely important story that's on the air on Monday is repeated Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and they're meaningless stories. But I guess part of the reason for that is, you know, the cable news channels have to fill up 24 hours a day.
Well, maybe you should go back on TV every day, Walter Jacobson, or maybe you should manage a newsroom. Do you want to do that?
I'm not much of a manager. I'm too difficult to be a manager. But I would like to manage because I have been fighting this fight about more significant and meaningful news than in local news. You know, the problem is blood and fires lead. Blood and fires are the easiest things
right,
to cover.
Absolutely.
And news directors used to tell me when I'd walk in, or I'd even complain out of the ear until I got slapped down for it, and then I'd stop for a while and then start again. When I would say something like, what do we have to do that for? It's even racist. Every time there's a crime in Chicago, they put a picture of a black guy up on the screen because he's the one who committed the crime. And it foments racism. And it's not by design by the management. Management has decided that fires and drive-by shootings are what people want to see. And when I complain about it, they say, well, then why don't you go work for WBEZ or NPR? Because that's where it is. And one more thing.
Sure.
One more thing.
I invited you.
Management tells me that they don't take surveys, which I know is untrue, because I've been at the stations and I know what surveys were and were not taken. And surveys show them that people have very short attention spans. So you can't go more than 30 seconds on a story. And that's it. And they're sure not interested in what's going on with the budget in Springfield. Well, we have a responsibility to tell them that stuff.
And an obligation to find a way to make it interesting. Wow. So if budget talks at Springfield sound boring to you, then maybe the hook is your kid's school lunch is going to go up 35 cents a day next week because of the budget in Springfield or something like that. You know, it's not easy, but I think that's the job if they're going to make those things relevant.
Well, maybe good reporting doesn't equate with articulation.
Let me read you a couple of texts. So what sources are impartial, Walter?
What sources are impartial? That's a very good question.
815 says Fox News frequently says they are giving opinion and the shows are not news but opinion. So they say Fox News is right up front about that. I don't know if you agree
They've
with that.
They've become increasingly upfront about that. Sean Hannity has been saying it.
And I think CNN is losing its way on that line particularly.
Right.
John, I've stopped watching cable news because I can't stand all the opinionating. John, don't we need to blame us, the viewers? They put on what we want to watch. That's an interesting observation.
Isn't it?
This person says, John, Walter's got it wrong. Rachel Maddow does superb research and backs up her shows with it, which is why she's won so many awards. And some people are agreeing with you and some people aren't, Walter Jacobson.
Yeah. My feeling about Rachel Maddow is that she is absolutely brilliant. She does her job beautifully, but she just needs to calm down a little bit. But that's just a personal annoyance. And when she says things that I know are not true, they all do that.
Yeah. Walter Jacobson's commentaries are heard Thursday mornings on Steve Cochran's show. He works just down the hall from me. It's a pleasure to bump into you again today, sir. Thanks for coming in.
Always. Thanks again for inviting me.
All right, I'm all done. Rokan, Anna DeVlantis are down the hall. Hi, campers. How are you? Good, I trust.
Hi, John. We were just commenting here in studio, someone who you had on last week. The Jeopardy winner just keeps winning, this guy.
Oh, did he win again today?
Yes. So he's on a roll.
Yeah.
On a roll, they say 2.5 million.
2.5, so he's
33 games.
Has he won that many?
Yeah.
He's in third place now. Ken Jennings had like 3-something, and then some other guy had 4 million. So
right.
Still got a ways to go.
Fascinating that he's a professional gambler.
All right, I'm all done. Rokan, Anna DeVlantis are down the hall. Hi, campers. How are you? Good, I trust.
Hi, John. We were just commenting here in studio, someone who you had on last week. The Jeopardy winner just keeps winning, this guy.
Oh, did he win again today?
Yes. So he's on a roll.
Yeah.
On a roll, they say 2.5 million.
2.5, so he's
33 games.
Has he won that many?
Yeah.
He's in third place now. Ken Jennings had like 3-something, and then some other guy had 4 million, so
right.
Still got a ways to go.
Fascinating that he's a professional gambler, he says, and he has these strategies about just doubling down and
betting
big.
Bill and Wendy were talking about. Bill was just amazed, not just at his knowledge, but the way he was playing the game.
The strategy.
Well, and he doesn't start like if it's 2, 4, 6, 800, or 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
He may start at 1,000. mm-hmm. or 800 because he's searching for the double jeopardies or the daily doubles. And, you know, he just plays the game in a weird way. Even the money he wagers
right.
At the end is interesting.
Naperville guy. We'll have to have him back again after this.
So what else is what's going on with you?
You're
going
to be on the program.
Oh, that's right. I'm coming on a little later on.
Yeah.
News or Ruse.
You're going to play News or Ruse, which, you know, it's never as easy as it seems. When you're playing
true.
At home, first of all, the studio looks much bigger on television than it actually is. But secondly, it is one of those games where you're like, oh, I could have gotten that right. And then when you're sitting in the chair and you actually have to do it,
uh-huh.
it's like a totally different situation.
Plus, I can't get the buzzer to work in time.
Right. That's it. No, in your case, we just go right to you. And it's you and your co-contestant
right.
Having to decide your play on this. And I'm going to tell you this right now.
Yeah.
I'm predicting you're going to win. I already put a 500 on you already today. So
yeah, I bet you're good at this, John.
Oh, bro, get it back.
I just talked to our bookie, and I was because we got one
show
for
bookie.
The show. Yeah, show
yeah,
bookie.
We have that guy.
They're making book on
yeah.
news or
oh
news.
Yeah, we make book on everything.
Wow,
we do an over under on Lauren's traffic. We got a whole thing. She's constantly coming in on the under. That's really crazy. All right. Well,
thank you. I'll see you in a little bit.
Yeah, we'll see you in a little bit.